This program is provided by lawyer Kyungjin Kim.
I want to take you back to a very specific quiet moment in 2012.
Okay.
Picture this modest, slightly messy bedroom in a house in Toronto.
Oh, yeah.
It smells faintly of, you know, that warm electronic smell. And on the desk, sitting completely exposed without a proper computer case or anything, are two humming consumer graphics cards.
It's just sitting right out in the open.
Right out in the open. They're NVIDIA GeForce GTX 580s.
Right.
Bought from a local computer shop for, I think, about $500 each.
Yeah, that sounds about right for the time.
Now, out in the rest of the world, people are lining up for the brand new iPhone 5.
Yeah.
Teenagers are using these exact same graphics cards to play games like Skyrim.
Exactly, yeah. Skyrim was huge then.
Right. But in this room, a young student named Alex Krzyzewski isn't rendering video game dragons.
No, he's definitely not.
He has wired these cheap, off-the-shelf fans and circuit boards together to run an experiment that is, well, it's about to render the world's most expensive supercomputers entirely obsolete.
It's wild. And the visual of that, just that exposed hardware sitting on a messy desk, it's the perfect encapsulation of how historical turning points actually happen.
It really is.
You know, we're conditioned to look for like ribbon-cutting ceremonies at multi-billion-dollar research facilities when we think about scientific breakthroughs.
Yeah, guys in pristine white lab coats.
Exactly. But that humming sound in the Toronto bedroom was something entirely different. It was the sound of theoretical mathematics, a video game component, and just sheer stubborn persistence colliding.
Which brings us perfectly to what we're doing here. Welcome to the Deep Dive.
Glad to be here.
Our mission today for you, the listener, is to pull apart Chapter 7 of the book Jensen Huang, The Caesar of Silicon.
Such a fascinating chapter.
It really is. We are exploring the exact moment the AI revolution truly began.
Mm.
But we're looking at it through a very specific lens today.
Right, because this isn't just a technical breakdown of how microchips evolve.
Yeah, not at all.
At its core, this chapter is basically a masterclass in the philosophy of the build.
Yeah.
It's the story of a leader making an incredibly lonely, heavily mocked 10-year bet.
Oh, the mockery was intense.
Brutal. And it shows how a willingness to suffer for a future that literally nobody else can see paved the way for the reality we all live in today.
So to fully grasp the magnitude of that 10-year bet, we have to look at the massive wall the scientific community was just slamming its head against back in 2012.
Right, the ImageNet Challenge.
Yes, the ImageNet Challenge.
Yeah.
Which was essentially the Olympics of computer vision.
That's a good way to put it.
And the task sounds laughably simple to a human being, right? You just look at a digital image and determine if it's a cat or a dog.
That's simple for us, yeah.
Right. But for decades, brilliant computer scientists had been throwing millions of dollars in grant money at this problem, and their software was just failing miserably.
Because they were going about it the wrong way.
Yeah, I pulled up some of the old methodology they were using before 2012, and it's fascinatingly tedious.
Oh, it was a nightmare.
They were trying to basically manually write a million-page instruction manual on how to see.
Rule-based programming.
Exactly, traditional rule-based coding.
Mm-hmm.
So a scientist would actually type out a line of code saying, you know, if the image contains a shape with two pointy triangles on top, it equals a cat.
Right. Or if a pink oval hangs out of the mouth area, it equals a dog.
But, I mean, think about a cat. It can curl into a tight ball or hide inside a cardboard box or just look away from the camera.
The variations are infinite.
Infinite, which makes hard-coded rules completely useless.
Yeah, the edge cases just break the system immediately.
So the team in Toronto, they just abandoned the manual entirely.
Yeah.
They wanted to use deep learning.
Which is a huge shift.
Right. And deep learning is often compared to, well, showing a toddler 1,000 pictures of cats
mm-hmm.
until the toddler's brain just magically gets it without needing to know the specific geometry of a pointy ear.
We should probably peel back the word magically there, though.
Fair point. Fair point.
Because what the toddler's brain is actually doing is the key to this entire technological revolution.
Right.
A human brain doesn't use magic. It uses biological weight adjustment.
Okay. Unpack that a bit.
So every time a toddler looks at a dog and incorrectly guesses cat, a specific neural pathway in their brain gets slightly weaker. And when they get it right, the connection strengthens. Deep learning is simply the attempt to recreate that exact process, but digitally.
You build layers of artificial neurons.
Exactly. You build these layers and you feed them data. The network guesses, checks its answer, and then goes back and mathematically adjusts millions of digital weights and connections to be just slightly more accurate for the next guess.
But adjusting millions of digital weights after every single image, that requires an astronomical amount of math.
Astronomical.
Like, if we think about those digital weights, like a massive soundboard with a million different volume sliders.
I like that analogy.
Right. You have to tune every single slider simultaneously to find the perfect frequency. And standard computer processors, mm-hmm. the CPUs, they turn one slider at a time.
Yeah, they're sequential.
Right. They are brilliant at doing complex tasks sequentially. But if you ask a CPU to train a deep neural network...
Oh, it could take a year just to run a single trial.
A year?
Yeah. And that sequential bottleneck is exactly why deep learning had essentially been relegated to the dusty, underfunded corners of academia for years.
People kind of gave up on it.
Basically, yeah.
Yeah.
The math worked perfectly on paper, but the physical time required to execute it made it practically impossible.
Until Toronto.
Right. Alex Krzyzewski, working under Professor Jeffrey Hinton and alongside a researcher named Ilya Sutskever, they realized that a standard computer processor was just the wrong tool for the job.
So they looked at graphics processing units, GPUs.
Like that $500 GeForce GTX 580 sitting on the desk.
Right, because the sole purpose of a graphics card is to calculate the color, lighting, and shadow of millions of individual pixels on a computer screen simultaneously.
60 times a second?
60 times a second. It doesn't turn one slider at a time. It has thousands of tiny cores that operate in parallel, turning thousands of sliders at the exact same moment.
It's beautiful, really. The parallel architecture, designed to render a hyper-realistic explosion in a video game, just happened to be the exact mathematical engine required to adjust millions of artificial neural weights.
A total accident of hardware evolution.
Absolutely. So instead of waiting for access to a massive national supercomputer, which they couldn't afford anyway, they just bought the gaming cards.
Wired them together
and let the parallel cores chew through the ImageNet data.
And the climax of this is September 30, 2012.
Yes.
They revealed their creation, which they called AlexNet.
Right.
And it dropped the image recognition error rate from roughly 26% down to 15%.
Which is unheard of.
Unheard of. They beat the second place team by a massive 10 percentage points.
Yeah, Professor Jan LeCun from NYU, who's, you know, one of the founding fathers of AI, he immediately recognized it as a definitive turning point in history.
Theory and parallel hardware had finally aligned.
Finally.
But, and this is where I think the story gets really interesting, the hardware alone is completely useless without the software to speak to it.
Right.
Because I looked into how Alex actually programmed those gaming cards, and the math just doesn't add up.
What do you mean?
Well, in 2012, a graphics card only understood instructions related to rendering polygons and textures.
Right, video game stuff.
Exactly. You couldn't just feed it a scientific algorithm for a neural network. It wouldn't know what to do with it.
No, it wouldn't.
There had to be a piece of translation software sitting between the scientific code and the consumer hardware, or that whole Toronto experiment would have been impossible.
And that translation software is the hidden architecture behind the entire AI revolution.
Yes.
It brings us right to the core philosophy of NVIDIA's CEO, Jensen Huang.
Because he built it.
He did. 6 years before the Toronto bedroom experiment, back in 2006, Jensen released a software platform called CUDA.
CUDA.
Right. It was a programming interface that allowed developers to send general-purpose scientific computing tasks directly to the parallel cores of a GPU.
Bypassing the graphics rendering entirely.
Completely bypassing it.
But I mean, I have to challenge the business logic of releasing CUDA in 2006.
Oh, it was a terrible business decision at the time.
If you look at NVIDIA's balance sheets from that era, they're just printing money by selling graphics hardware to the teenage gaming market.
Yeah, they were dominating that space.
Right. So pivoting thousands of engineers to build a complex scientific compiler for a market that literally does not exist. It makes absolutely zero financial sense. Wall Street must have looked at this and thought the CEO had completely lost his mind.
They did. The financial markets punished them brutally for it.
I can imagine.
Investors were furious. They looked at this massive research and development budget being poured into a free software platform that practically nobody was using, and they mockingly labeled it the CDA tax.
The CDA tax?
Yeah. It was viewed as this reckless vanity project that was eating directly into the company's profit margins.
And the stock took a hit, right?
A huge hit. By 2007, the year following CUDA's release, NVIDIA's stock had collapsed by 70%.
70%?
Yeah.
A 70% drop is usually a career-ending event for a CEO. Activist investors usually step in and demand immediate restructuring at that point.
Oh, they tried.
I read that analysts would actually corner Jensen on earnings calls, demanding to know how he ever planned to monetize this scientific computing gamble.
And do you know what his answer was?
His completely honest, unvarnished answer was just, I don't know yet.
I don't know yet. It's incredible. He didn't have a spreadsheet predicting the birth of AI, but he had a macro-level thesis about the laws of physics.
Right, regarding Moore's Law.
Exactly. Jensen saw that Moore's Law, the historical rule that standard CPUs would predictably get faster and cheaper every year, he saw it was physically hitting a wall.
Transistors were getting so small they were brushing up against the limits of atomic physics.
Right, you can only make them so small. He believed the only way forward for the computing industry was accelerated, parallel processing.
But he faced this massive chicken and egg dilemma.
A classic platform problem.
Yeah, because developers won't spend time learning a complex new programming language if there are no chips to run it on. And hardware engineers won't build new chips if there is no software ecosystem to support them.
So Jensen's solution was just to endure the financial pain and force the ecosystem into existence himself.
Brute force it.
Basically, yeah. He started planting seeds. He donated NVIDIA GPUs to universities and research labs globally.
Just gave them away.
Gave them away. He even funded university courses just to teach graduate students how to use CUD.
Wow.
His guiding principle during that entire decade of brutal stock performance was, if we don't build it, they can't come.
And he also had that quote, right, about having no customers.
Yeah, he believed that operating in a space with zero customers meant operating in a space with zero competitors.
That is such a bold way to look at a 70% stock drop.
He was building a moat while everyone else was laughing at him.
So the only reason Alex Krizhevsky and Ilya Sutskever could execute the AlexNet breakthrough in 2012 was because Jensen had spent the previous 6 years absorbing that stock crash to ensure the CUDA ecosystem was sitting there fully matured and waiting for them.
Exactly. And when Jensen saw the results of the AlexNet paper, he grasped the implications instantly.
He knew what it meant.
He didn't view it as a victory in some niche image sorting contest. He recognized that the students in Toronto had inadvertently built a universal learning machine.
Because if you can train a neural network to recognize the patterns of a cat just by feeding it data,
you can scale that network to recognize the patterns of the English language or the patterns of cellular biology. Or human driving.
The response to that realization from NVIDIA was incredibly aggressive.
Oh, immediate pivot.
Yeah. Jensen sent a Friday night email to the entire company. He essentially stated, we are no longer a graphics company. We are now an AI company.
Just like that.
He took an organization of thousands of people, an organization built entirely around video game rendering, and demanded they pivot to building massive silicon chips specifically for AI data centers.
He crossed his own Rubicon.
He really did. It was a massive existential risk.
It was, but Jensen was uniquely positioned to take it. Because he had already suffered through the 10-year trial of building the foundation with CUD, he was standing on the beach watching the tide roll out before anyone else even knew there was an ocean.
That's a great metaphor. Because the AlexNet breakthrough, it proved the theory, but it also created an entirely new crisis.
Compute starvation.
Yes, compute starvation. Suddenly, every tech giant on the planet realizes deep learning works, and they begin aggressively hoarding GPUs.
Google, Facebook, Amazon.
Yeah, they're all building these massive proprietary supercomputers. And sitting amidst these titans in 2016 is a small, newly formed nonprofit called OpenAI.
Right, tiny little startup.
They're working out of this shabby, unglamorous office in San Francisco with a mission to build safe AI. But they are fundamentally bottlenecked by a lack of hardware.
They couldn't get their hands on enough compute.
Exactly.
Because to compete with a giant like Google, OpenAI needed way more than just a few gaming cards wired together. They needed industrial-scale parallel processing.
And NVIDIA answered that compute starvation by inventing the DGX-1.
The DGX-1, the world's first AI supercomputer in a box.
The stats on this thing are wild.
Oh, they're ridiculous. It housed 8 massively powerful GPUs and delivered 170 teraflops of computing power. It
weighed 32 kilos.
Contained 35,000 individual parts.
And it took $2 billion in research and development to engineer.
Yeah, and they priced it at $129,000.
Okay, wait, a $2 billion R&D bill for a computer that fits in a large server rack requires some unpacking here.
It does sound extreme.
Why did it cost so much to build? Mm-hmm. I mean, you can't just take 8 massive GPUs and plug them into a standard computer motherboard, right?
No, you can't. The parallel processors are so fast that standard networking cables essentially create a massive traffic jam.
Oh, okay.
The GPUs end up just sitting there idle, waiting for data to arrive. So NVIDIA had to invent entirely new physical architecture, like the NVLink interconnect, just to feed data to the cores fast enough to keep them busy.
So they're inventing new physics, essentially.
Pretty much. And the statistics are staggering, but the why behind the numbers is what really matters here.
Right.
170 teraflops means the machine can perform 170 trillion math operations every single second.
Unbelievable.
For the researchers at OpenAI, that raw power altered the physics of their daily work. It meant a neural network training experiment that previously took 6 months of agonizing waiting could now be completed in 3 days.
Wow. From 6 months to 3 days.
Yeah. Those 35,000 intricately engineered parts eliminated the data bottlenecks. It allowed the researchers to iterate, fail, learn, and adjust at a speed that was previously the exclusive domain of trillion-dollar tech monopolies.
And the way the very first DGX-1 was delivered is arguably one of the most revealing moments in the whole book.
It's my favorite story.
So Jensen unveils this $129,000 machine at a conference, mm-hmm. and the crowd is completely baffled.
They don't get it at all.
No. People are literally asking if it runs Windows.
Yeah.
But Elon Musk, who was funding OpenAI at the time, raises his hand and says, "We need that."
And Jensen doesn't just put the machine on a pallet and hand it to a logistics company.
No, he acts like a billionaire DoorDash driver.
He really does.
He loads this massive 32-kilo supercomputer into the trunk of his own car and personally drives it across San Francisco to OpenAI's shabby office.
Because he wanted to place it into their hands himself.
Yeah.
Waiting at the office were Elon Musk, Sam Altman, and Ilya Sutskever.
Wait, Ilya, that's the same young researcher who was in the Toronto bedroom 4 years earlier?
The exact same guy.
That is incredible.
It's an amazing full circle moment. So Jensen took a silver marker and actually signed the casing of the DGX-1.
What did he write?
He wrote, "To Elon and the OpenAI team, for the future of computing and humanity."
Wow.
Because he viewed OpenAI not merely as a customer purchasing hardware. He saw them as pioneers charting an unknown frontier. He wasn't just selling them metal and silicon. He was selling them time.
He was hand-delivering the oven they needed to bake the ChatGPT cake.
That's exactly what it was.
Andres Karpathy, who was another brilliant researcher at OpenAI, he looked at the DGX-1 and publicly stated that with this level of compute power, they would soon be conversing with machines as if they were human.
And he was right. 6 years later, in 2022, they launched ChatGPT.
Fundamentally altering the trajectory of human history.
Yep.
And all of it traces back to that personal delivery from the trunk of a car.
The narrative arc from that Toronto bedroom to the OpenAI office really demonstrates the compounding return of Jensen with patience.
Definitely.
But the story has an incredible full circle moment that highlights the sheer scale of what that patience built.
Let's fast forward a bit.
Yeah, let's look at October 2025. Jensen Huang is once again making a personal hand-signed delivery to Elon Musk.
But the setting has completely transformed.
Oh, entirely. They are no longer standing in a cramped San Francisco startup office.
Right. They're standing at Starbase.
The massive rocket launch facility in Texas.
Right next to the largest rocket ever constructed by humanity.
And Jensen is delivering the DGX Spark.
The visual contrast of this moment is profound.
Yeah.
The DGX Spark is the world's smallest supercomputer, and it's being handed over in the shadow of this towering spacecraft.
It's poetic. In 2016, delivering the massive DGX-1 was a speculative gamble on a tiny nonprofit.
Yeah.
But by 2025, NVIDIA is a $4 trillion empire.
$4 trillion.
Every sovereign nation, every global enterprise, and every tech giant is lining up, absolutely desperate for their silicon.
And the power of the original DGX-1 has been miniaturized and democratized into the Spark.
Exactly. Yet, despite the astronomical shift in valuation and geopolitical power, Jensen's guiding philosophy remains utterly untouched.
It's still the exact same.
His stance is still, if a developer needs a GPU, the answer is yes.
The philosophy of the build survived the scale.
It really did.
We have traced this timeline from a couple of cheap gaming cards humming on a messy desk in 2012 to a desperately needed supercomputer delivered out of a car trunk to a $4 trillion empire fueling rocket science in 2025.
Quite the journey.
And, you know, The AI revolution is constantly framed in the media as a sudden, spontaneous explosion of innovation, like it happened overnight.
But it was the exact opposite.
Right. It was a methodical, painful 10-year investment in CUD. It was built squarely on the back of public mockery and a 70% stock collapse.
And that timeline forces us to ask a deeply uncomfortable question about our own approaches to building.
Yeah.
Jensen endured a decade of hostility from Wall Street because he was building a software foundation for a market that did not yet exist.
He took the hits.
He absorbed the pain, trusting that if he built the ecosystem, the innovators would eventually arrive and utilize it.
It makes you examine your own career or, you know, your own creative projects or your own business strategy.
Absolutely.
What unseen foundations are you avoiding because the payoff isn't immediate?
Right. What impossible problem are you failing to solve today simply because you refuse to suffer through building the foundation?
A foundation that might not yield a single result for another 10 years.
Exactly. Are you willing to pay your own version of the CUD day? Or you're just sitting around hoping for a lucky break?
Because as the Toronto Bedroom proves,
luck had absolutely nothing to do with it.
This program is provided by lawyer Kyungjin Kim.